trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. Look, the battle for your mind is a very real thing. And this program does not exist to tell you what to think. I do this show to invite you to think more clearly and independently about the world around us. And I encourage you to join me each weekday to find courage and camaraderie among your fellow wrong thinkers and to claim your heritage as a free individual. Our program is brought to you by great sponsors like MonticelloCollege.org, also by our friends at Patriot Home Mortgage, that's the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage in St. George, Utah, as well as LifesavingFood.com. And I would encourage you to go to my sponsor links, which you will find in my daily show notes at TheBrianHydeShow.com. Just click on them. You can send them some love. You can do business with them if you want, or just send them an email or something. Tell them, hey, I heard your message. So, where to begin? I think I want to start. Unfortunately, I'd love to start on a happy note. Today, there was an abundance of puppies and kittens and things that weren't in the least troubling, you know, in the news. But I'm seeing some pretty troubling stuff right now, and particularly as I look toward Australia. I don't know if it's ever been more clear why people who desire absolute control must take away the citizenry's right to defend itself, take away their right to keep and bear arms. I mean, I can think of about a half dozen videos that I have seen over the weekend, and I did not spend a lot of time online. This is just stuff that popped up on Twitter. But the police in Australia, wow. They are serving and protecting the crap out of these people. I mean, you know, so somebody said something as they show police, you know, swarming and taking to the ground a maskless couple on a beach. Now, keep in mind, they're outdoors, but that doesn't matter, apparently. The police swarm and take this couple to the ground, and someone says, well, I'm glad to see that Australia is finally getting serious about their COVID policies instead of half-assing it like they were before. I'm just blown away at the increasing level of brutality that's being exerted. And it's against peaceful people. Somebody simply being outside without a mask, but the police will swarm them. They will take them down, arrest them. I actually have a very iconic photo. I've got to figure out how to put this one into the show notes. But it's a picture of a guy, hands handcuffed behind his back, being restrained by about five or six police officers, while another officer is forcing a mask onto the guy's face. I mean, this is the iconic photo of where we are headed. This is right up there with the iconic photos of, you know, the first black students being, you know, ushered into Little Rock High School, you know, while people who were segregationists are standing there screaming at them. It's really disturbing. But it also portends that, look, if it can happen in Australia, this is not some backwards communist country. This was a first world nation where people were largely pretty free up until a little over a year ago. And in a year, Australia has gone to a full-blown police state. And I don't say this with any desire to see violence. I think violence needs to be a regrettable last resort. But as I see the way that the police are treating the citizens there in Australia, this question seriously popped into my mind. Why hasn't somebody started shooting? Why hasn't somebody stepped in? Because they know, you know, the police have all the force. The police have the guns. Again, I don't think violence is something that's laudable and let's all get involved. But I also think there's a time and a place for it. And frankly, from what I see coming out of Australia, I think they've hit that time and place. It's really disturbing. And I think one of the hardest things for us, okay, so we're not Australia, right? You're listening. I do have listeners in Australia, and mate, my heart goes out to you. There are freedom-loving people in Australia right now who see clearly what is happening. And, you know, they're being denied, you know, the basic means of protecting themselves, and they're being told everything they have to do. And I think that this should serve as a warning for the rest of us. You know, one of the biggest challenges we have, people can see, and I don't think that it's hard to convince people that, you know, we're moving in a very authoritarian direction. Are we sure we want to go this way? But it appears that a sizable portion of the American public is either A, okay with it, maybe they like their statism, or B, they see the movement and they see the direction it's going, but don't think we're ever really going to get there, right? At some point, everybody's going to wake up, something's going to happen, we're going to see something, go, well, okay, that's enough, let's rein it in and let's make the police state step back down. I don't think it works that way. In fact, Caitlin Johnstone, who is from Australia, says one of the biggest issues that we have is people don't understand how unfree we already are. Can you see where that would be a problem? We don't even, a lot of people, I'm not saying you or me, but a lot of people don't recognize how much freedom we've actually lost. Caitlin Johnstone says one of the biggest and most widespread blind spots among those who oppose totalitarian control by the powerful is the assumption it hasn't already been achieved. She says we've been so busy watching out for the next overtly totalitarian dictatorship that wants to put the jackboot on our necks that we never notice the covert totalitarians sliding the shackles around our minds. Caitlin Johnstone writes, everyone thinks about the abusers who beat their spouses, but not the abusers who dominate their spouses' minds with psychological manipulation. Everyone thinks about psychopathic killers prowling the streets, but not the psychopathic killers who rule our world via mass-scale manipulation. By the way, as an aside, if I can just give an example of this. Following the bombing at the Kabul airport that killed 13 U.S. service members and dozens of Afghans and other, you know, innocent people, the Biden administration announced, well, we took out this ISIS-K leader and, you know, we did it with a drone strike and sent a strong message about how you can't mess with us. You don't hear the press trumpeting this a lot, but closer investigation done by those who still are journalists revealed it wasn't some terrorist mastermind. It wasn't even an ISIS member. It was an aid worker returning home after delivering water to people all over Kabul, returning home to his kids, and it was seven of his children who were blown apart in that drone strike. And yet, do you think anything is ever going to happen? Do you think the people who ordered that killing, who celebrated, who talked about how it shows how strong and how our resolve is, do you think they're ever going to miss a meal? Do you think they're ever going to spend a night in jail? Hardly. So Caitlin Johnstone has a point here. You think about the psychopathic killers prowling the streets, but nobody thinks about the psychopathic killers who would order drone strikes against innocent people and then celebrate it and then quietly just let that one go down the memory hole when it turns out that they killed the wrong person and a whole bunch of innocent people along with the wrong person. Sorry, that one gets under my skin. That one actually takes my blood pressure up just a notch. Caitlin Johnstone says conspiracy analysts warned the government is trying to give everyone a social credit score to force us all to comply with the agendas of the powerful. In nations where mass-scale narrative management through the media and online algorithms already manipulates people into complying with the agendas of the powerful. She says people assume they aren't already behaving exactly how the powerful want them to behave within a civilization whose political, monetary, and economic systems are already completely under the control of the powerful. People think they are free just because they can go and buy whatever they want in an economy rigged for the powerful, using money rigged for the powerful, because they can say whatever they want on internet platforms whose algorithms are manipulated by the powerful, because they can vote for a politician who only got on the ballot by being owned by the powerful. I know it makes me uncomfortable too, but I still think she's telling the truth here. I think she's right. People think they're free because the system let them elect a populist like Donald Trump, even after that populist spent 4 years doing little but advancing the interests of the powerful. People think they're free because they elect progressives, But the system lets them elect progressives like Bernie Sanders or AOC. Even though those progressives always stop short when it comes time to challenge real power. We're going to come back to Caitlin Johnstone's article here in just a few moments. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. I've mentioned before there are many things on which Caitlin Johnstone and I wouldn't see eye to eye. But I think on the really important stuff, she sees it clearly. And I see it too. And that's why I would ask you, consider her voice as one of those voices out there to fill in the gaps and give you a more complete picture of what's going on, not just here at home, but around the world.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. You heard me talk about lifesavingfood.com, and hopefully it's something that you took. I noticed a lot of people, I was hearing from my friend Kendall Whiting, who runs a lifesavingfood.com website and the business there. He was saying that, we got some really good response last week when he was throwing the special for my listeners to celebrate National Preparedness Month, which is just about done. We're about to flip the calendar page once again. Well, I want to assure you right now, they still have great stocks of food. The special, unfortunately, is over. If you hesitated, if you decided, oh, I'm going to wait and see if it'll last, sorry, it's done. But you'll still find a tremendous collection of food storage and starter kits and long-term kits and survival kits and 72-hour kits and so forth. You can do it big, or you can just, do it piecemeal, fill in some gaps in your own plan. But please visit lifesavingfood.com. There's a link in my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. I'm sharing with you an article here from Caitlin Johnstone. And I do have a link to this in the show notes as well. People don't understand how unfree we actually are, or we already are. Some people see it. Well, it's coming. By gosh, there's going to be some things that are going to be ugly if we don't do something about it. There's a lot that's already in place, though. No, we're not under a total police state. We're not totally under the jackboot. But we've come a lot further than many realize. This is hard for me. I've been paying very close attention for about the last 30 years. And it's still hard for me to bust through the cognitive dissonance of seeing it and appreciating it for what it is, which is, wow, we are far down that path. Caitlin Johnstone says, people spent generations arguing for the right to own guns so they can defend themselves against tyranny, while the iron bars of tyranny were quietly being constructed around them the entire time. She says Western leftists are so busy arguing with each other, they haven't noticed that the left has been so effectively sabotaged, hijacked, subverted, and neutered in our society that it's now little more than a glorified group chat. Silicon Valley megacorporations have... Silicon Valley, that is. Sorry. Silicon Valley, probably a different place. Might be a fun place to hang out. Who knows? Silicon Valley megacorporations have intimate relationships with powerful government agencies. And those agencies are almost certainly harvesting everyone's data to fine-tune their propaganda operations on the public based on what our information tells them about our thoughts and feelings on subjects relevant to status quo power agendas. If our information is valuable enough to make Facebook into a trillion-dollar company via surveillance capitalism, well, Caitlin Johnstone says, then we can be absolutely certain that our information is also valuable enough for opaque government agencies to work on gathering that information for its own purposes. The science of modern propaganda has been in research and development for more than a century, which is an eternity when you think of all the advances in other military technologies that have been achieved during that time. They're only getting better and better at this. Now the internet has given them unprecedented access to the inner workings of our collective psychology. So a wife who's been psychologically dominated into doing everything her husband wants doesn't notice she's being abused because she isn't being beaten into those things. She thinks she's doing what she wants to do. A population that's been psychologically dominated into doing everything the powerful want doesn't notice that it's being tyrannized. because it isn't being forced to do those things at gunpoint. People think they're doing what they want to do. She says none of the people warning of Orwellian dystopia get it. We're already there. We're already marching in perfect alignment with what our rulers desire for us. We just haven't noticed because we're still able to eat McDonald's and watch internet porn. They're still tightening those bolts in various ways to make sure that we don't escape our prison, but she says, make no mistake, the prison walls are already fully constructed and have been for some time. Now, the walls aren't physical, and the chains are affixed to our minds. But what's the functional difference between a populace which obeys the powerful because it's forced to, and a population which obey or populace that obeys the powerful because it was manipulated into wanting to? Wow. That's actually a pretty powerful question there. She says we're trapped, we're checkmated, as long as our minds continue to operate in a way that can be easily manipulated. Now, Caitlin Johnstone says it's possible that humanity can collectively break free from this propaganda-induced trance by means of a mass-scale psychological transformation out of our unhealthy relationship with mental narrative, but she says there actually are some signs that such a transformation may be on its way. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Every species comes to a point where it either makes the adaptations necessary for its survival or it doesn't. And as the powerful use the chains around our minds to march us all toward an existential cliff's edge of ecocide and nuclear brinkmanship, she says we're about to find out which one we are. Okay, she's taking a pretty hardcore stance here, and I can understand, wow, this might make some people feel a little uncomfortable, to hear that the tyranny is worse than what they'd realized, and secondly, to think that they were going along with it at some level. Look, I don't know what the answer is, other than I know what the principles and practices of freedom are. I believe that there are some things that are absolutely worth standing up for, even if it comes at personal risk. And though I haven't been, you know, I don't think I've been the stalwart example of this that I would like to be, I've had the great fortune of being able to keep company with people who do walk that walk. And by that association, I'm becoming the person that I would like to be, albeit slowly. I think one of the biggest decisions that we have to make is at the individual level. We have to resolve to be free or to be a beacon of freedom. And that doesn't mean wave the flag harder, chant louder, and, you know, go to more political rallies. That might be a part for some people. But I think the biggest part is simply crossing that threshold in our mind that says, I will be a free person. I will not live by the permission of whomever thinks that they are, you know, in charge of me. I'm not going to be a puppet. And it's a pretty revolutionary act for someone to think that way. I'm sorry, there's no way around it. You cannot assert your freedoms. You cannot assert your love of liberty or your love of freedom of conscience or freedom of religion or freedom of speech or freedom of association. You can't assert your support for private property rights and the protection of our natural rights without some people seeing and portraying you as a threat, you know, a problem. You're a troublemaker. You're a gadfly. So you better get used to people, you know, questioning your motives, calling you names, making some very harsh judgments about what you're really trying to do, and in some cases calling for your imprisonment or your death. I know. I don't want to believe it either. But then again, look at how people have reacted just over COVID policies. Look at how people have been trained to hate the unvaccinated. The psychological conditioning that Caitlin Johnstone is talking about is just as real as can be. And again, I don't have all the answers. I don't know. Do we fix this from the top down? You know, I don't think we do. I think the way that we fix it, at least in our immediate vicinity, is first and foremost, recognize it for what it is and resolve right to the core of our being, I will not be a channel through which more of that attitude comes into the world. I won't share the lies. I won't perpetuate the lust for control over other people. I don't care how big of a toehold this mindset has. It won't be coming into the world because of me and my efforts. I know you might think, but I'm just one person. How does that make a difference? I don't know what to tell you other than it does. You have influence on people around you to a far greater degree than you think. We all do. It's just a matter of using that influence wisely. Knowing who you are, knowing what you stand for.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
All right, once again, welcome back to the show. And by the way, thank you. I know there are so many voices out there to choose from, so many different sources of information. For whatever reason you decided to give it a try, or maybe you're a longtime listener, thanks for sticking with me. I really appreciate you giving me a shot. As I mentioned before, I don't ever have all the answers. I don't have omniscience. I don't claim to know how it all shakes out. But I do have a fairly strong sense of right and wrong, and I'm not afraid to speak up to those truths that I've committed to. I'll do my very best not to mislead you, but I'll definitely give you some things to think about that will hopefully get you thinking a little more broadly and a little more clearly and independently about the world around us. By the way, my show is brought to you by great sponsors like the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage. It's a wild real estate market in the state of Utah right now, but if you are within the state of Utah and hearing my voice, you have the opportunity, especially if you're one of the people moving to Utah, to take advantage of some very, very low interest rates. And if you're looking to refinance your home or if you're looking to buy a home, VA loan, traditional loan, reverse mortgage, the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage has the stability and the clout to help you get the loan you're looking for, and most importantly, to do it without delay. Yeah, timing is of the essence. Now, you can contact Heather at 703-4522. Sorry, that's area code 435, 703-4522. If you're in St. George, Utah, visit her office at 619 South Bluff Street. Heather's NMLS ID is 715386, and Patriot Home Mortgage is an equal housing opportunity lender. You know, I've been paying attention to the colleges and universities for probably the last 25 years or so. I've watched as they have become the proving grounds for politically correct thought and for, creating new social justice warriors. This has been going on for decades. And it used to be, if you wanted to find out, what's the most unfree place in the world? 20 years ago, a little more than 20 years ago, prior to 9/11, I would have told you, a college campus. That's where you're going to find political correctness starting to, metastasize and really take hold. And it's where you'll find speech codes. It's where anybody who has a differing opinion is going to be shouted down. It's only gotten worse in that time. I mean, come on, now they have safe spaces, and anybody comes to speak at a particular university and, oh, they're not on target with, whatever this ideological faction wants. Well, we'll get violent. We'll do everything we can to prevent them from speaking. Pretty crazy stuff. And I guess another example of that authoritarian attitude has been seen in how many colleges and universities have proven to be pretty big heel clickers when it comes to their COVID policies. In fact, Michael Tracy is warning that we need to be careful because academia is establishing a permanent surveillance bureaucracy that he says will soon govern the rest of the country. This is published on his Substack, and I have a link to this in the show notes. Michael Tracy says, having now received a tsunami of messages from people across the U.S. and a few internationally about the surveillance regimes being permanently installed at their educational institutions, in contravention of earlier assurances that the current academic year would mark a long-awaited return to normalcy, thanks to the onset of mass vaccination, there are a few conclusions to draw. First, he says, unless and until COVID cases are abandoned as a metric by which policy action is presumptively dictated, these institutions are destined to continue flailing from irrational measure to irrational measure for the foreseeable future. Just turn your gaze over to one of America's most hallowed pedagogical grounds. As of September 17th, Columbia University has newly forbidden students from hosting guests, visiting residence halls other than their own, and gathering with more than 10 people. What's the stated rationale for these restrictions? Well, administrators have extrapolated from the contact tracing data they've compulsorily seized that a recent increase in viral transmission is attributable to students socializing unmasked at gatherings in residence halls and at off-campus apartments, bars, and restaurants. Socializing at apartments, bars, and restaurants in the middle of Manhattan? Wow! I can't imagine anything more heinous, says Michael Tracy. Just like Connecticut College and so many other institutions, he says, I've been taking flurries of messages about them. Columbia has now already mandated vaccination for all students, faculty, and staff, and they're approaching 100% compliance. But as has now been made abundantly clear, for many people in positions of bureaucratic authority, universal vaccination was never going to be sufficient for a transition away from the permanent emergency mode of COVID theology. The perverse incentives are easy to grasp. These administrators have so much invested in the infrastructure of case detection that they've constructed over the last year and a half, not to mention the wider ideological project of stopping the spread at all costs, that it's impossible to imagine conditions under which they'd voluntarily move to dismantle the surveillance systems over which they preside. And not just because the new powers conferred by this infrastructure, namely the ability to micromanage the private lives of young adults, track and adjudicate the propriety of their movements, etc., is probably creepily intoxicating on a level these administrators may not be overtly conscious of, and in any event would almost certainly never publicly admit. No, he says the infrastructure won't be dismantled anytime soon, because doing so would also require accepting a major paradigm shift in how COVID is understood. And for certain segments of society, the whole system of thought is just too all-consuming. Benign instances of transmission, in other words, transmission that results in no severe disease, which is almost invariably the case with vaccinated young adults at astronomically low risk from COVID, would have to stop being portrayed as alarming outbreaks, necessitating a never-ending stream of frenzied Zoom strategy meetings and swift, all-hands-on-deck interventionist tactics. In fact, he says the very word outbreak would also probably have to be ditched, given its alarmist connotations. He says, I would suggest instead that outbreak be applied to these frantic upswells of bureaucratic overreaction. Perhaps the epidemiological origins of this diseased mentality could be contact-traced. Ooh. I love this. Let's put that shoe on the other foot. Why should anyone be alarmed by an alleged outbreak of overwhelmingly asymptomatic or mild cases among a population of healthy, vaccinated undergrads? Cases which never would have been detected at all if not for the superfluous surveillance testing structures that these institutions require students to submit to. And before anyone chimes in with the standard, well, they could transmit to others, response, he says the others they've been surrounded by have had the opportunity to get vaccinated at no cost for the past 8 months. Even the U.S. prestige media is beginning to reject the utility of using cases as a benchmark for anything of consequence. So you'd think college administrators would eventually follow suit. But a combination of bureaucratic inertia and weirdly flamboyant zeal appears to be preventing that from happening. Michael Tracy says, having read way too much administrative jargon recently, there are a number of obnoxious rhetorical strategies they employ to engender acceptance of edicts that more and more people seem to recognize are wildly, overbearingly arbitrary. We all need to hold each other accountable, these administrators will often pronounce, or some variation thereof, which ironically shields them from accountability for their own capricious and intrusive actions. Their orders are often cloyingly filled with artificial appeals to the community, which raises the question of who elected these surveillers and snoops to be spokespersons for the community, and how they even define communities, which seems to contain growing segments of unwilling inhabitants. He says, one key thing that I know is that despite their pretension of acting in the direction of expert epidemiologists and public health officials, the day-to-day decisions about practical implementation at these places often come down to the individual discretion of officials who in no sane world would ever be deferred to on questions of infectious disease protocol or, really, anything of significance. The latest restrictions at Columbia were promulgated by the Dean of Undergraduate Student Life, one of those titles you know must encompass a whole slew of useless, indecipherable make-work, and now tends to include a never-ending cycle of COVID monitoring. In her official bio, Dean Kristen Scully Crom of Columbia is described as having an esteemed background in something called residence life and leadership oversight. Michael Tracy says, I don't know about you, but I can think of few things more unappealing than to have my personal activity surveilled by official busybodies who've dedicated their careers to learning the majesties of leadership oversight, which sounds like a field invented especially for people who enjoy receiving LinkedIn emails. It's a marvelous article. There's much more to it. I hope you'll take a look at it. It's included in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. Again, Michael Tracy, academia is establishing a permanent surveillance state. And the trouble is, like we saw with, you know, some of the things that have taken place at the airport and so forth, these things have a tendency to hang on long after their usefulness is done. So, I mean, if you thrive on authoritarianism, yeah, the airport's a good place to go. So is a college campus. At what point do people stop being scared and say enough? I suppose we're about to find out.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Listen, before I go any further, I just want to throw this reminder out there for you. The world is still a beautiful place. How do I know this? Well, I took a little sightseeing tour. As my friends know, I am Mr. Fall. Let me check. Yep, I'm wearing plaid. Don't have a pumpkin latte in front of me, but, you know, that's... Wouldn't be too far out of the question if I liked latte. But I went to go do some leaf watching over the weekend. Drove into the South Hills and just went bonkers for how beautiful it is. And it was nice for a couple of reasons. And I'm just offering this. If you have some place where you can go to just enjoy the fall leaves, do it. Number one, you can unplug from the matrix. You can unplug from all the bad news. Don't worry, I'll be here to tell you what's going on when you get back. But there's just something very restorative about being in nature and appreciating that beauty. And here's the best part. Anytime you make time in your life to unplug, and especially to get back to nature and to just appreciate what's there, you are proving the truth that beauty exists in this world and it is not reserved just for the elite. In other words, the Davos crowd, the very fancy people partying with Obama on Martha's Vineyard, it's not just for them. It's for you. You just got to be willing to put your hand out there and take it. So don't miss those opportunities. All right, moving on. People who thrive on centralized power seem to be among the loudest and most insistent proponents of telling others, follow the science. And there's a great article from Sheldon Richman. This was published on everythingvoluntary.com. Actually, everything-voluntary.com. Sheldon Richman warns that mixing science in the state is a sure way to get coercive policies that feed the government science complex and its harmful orthodoxies. He says the government science complex ostensibly promotes the search about facts for our world, but it actually promotes and enforces orthodoxy, protects resulting paradigms, and manufactures apparent consensuses that are questioned only at one's reputational peril. He says that's why I put the word science in quotation marks. I could have called it pseudoscience or junk science. Now he says in contrast to real science, science, in quotation marks, is little more than the broadcast of evidence-free alarms that politicians and bureaucrats, advised by anointed government-financed, in quotation marks, scientists, use to justify political action and expansion of government intrusion into our lives. The price, is liberty. Now, he says the procedure starts with a politically amenable conclusion and then moves to a search for confirmation, regardless of whatever intentions of good science and statistical analysis are required. Those who voice doubts about any of this, despite their credentials and previous standing, will be subjected to attacks even on their character. The official slogan of establishment science might as well be orthodoxy first, protect the paradigm. Now, someone of note saw this coming. In 1961, President Dwight Eisenhower gave his televised farewell address, which has become famous for its warning against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. Eisenhower went on to say, "We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together." Now, Sheldon Richman says, "It makes one want to cheer." Far less known but equally important in his eyes was Eisenhower's warning against the government's centralization of scientific research, which became a real concern after World War II and the onset of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. As he put it, quote, "akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial-military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded." Eisenhower went on to say, "Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should," he says, "we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite." End quote. Now, Sheldon Richman says this is truly remarkable, not to mention prescient. He says, "I don't know if Eisenhower was quite right. Has public policy become captive of a scientific technological elite, or is it the other way around? It's probably a combination of both." But he says, "We can readily understand how politicians and government grant managers would naturally be attracted to research that supports their wish for more, not less, power. Some scientists, who are after all human beings too, would then be tempted to cater to this demand, which can create its own supply. If the government shows no interest in financing research that proclaims X, Y, or Z is not a problem, justifying a political solution, wouldn't you expect the number of researchers inclined that way to dwindle?" He says, "For decades, scientists and their universities have gone through government cash, have prospered rather through government cash by spreading fear, either real but exaggerated or invented. And this has gone far beyond research on weapons and other narrow wartime missions. Three prominent examples since World War II are the fear of dietary animal fat and cholesterol, the fear of carbon dioxide, which all life depends on, and the fear of other people, specifically of catching COVID-19 from them. Now, this isn't to say that pre-vaccine COVID-19 was not a serious danger to identifiably vulnerable people, only that it's been exaggerated beyond all reason." Sheldon Richman says the point here is that this would have been far less likely, maybe even impossible, if scientific research funding were not concentrated in the government's hands, largely through universities which are hooked on taxpayer money. He says many people believe that the taxpayers must bear the biggest burden of scientific research because no one else has an interest in doing so. So this is in essence a public goods or externality argument for government finance. According to this argument, the cost of doing something would fall mostly on the doer, but the benefits would mostly fall on others. And charging free riders would be unfeasible, then no doer would have a business interest in the project. Now, that's said to be a market failure because everyone would miss out on a benefit. Thus, most economists have thought the government, with its exclusive power to tax, had to come to the rescue for the good of society. But he says that theory, like the theories used to justify the fears mentioned above, doesn't mirror the historical record. The insistence that basic research won't be done by private firms sounds like the fictional scientist who insisted the bumblebee was aerodynamically incapable of flying. He needed only to look out the window. Well, it turns out that private investment in research has been profitable when the government stayed out. Writers such as Terence Keeley, Patrick Michaels, and Matt Ridley have shown in recent books that countries that led the way in the Industrial Revolution were precisely those. Great Britain and the United States that had almost no government support for basic scientific research until rather late in the game. In other words, private business people found the required research profitable and changed the world. Keeley and Michaels show, moreover, that post-war U.S. government spending on basic science and research and development has not increased economic growth over the previous period. In fact, those writers also point out that revolutionary inventions by non-scientists have sometimes preceded or even stimulated interest in basic scientific research, the steam engine being a case in point. Moreover, the assertion that competitors will merely copy other firms' products, that is, free ride on others' research, is more myth than fact because, among other reasons, much knowledge is tacit and not freely attainable through reverse engineering. That certainly blunts the utilitarian case for patents. He says we shouldn't be surprised that decentralization, intellectual competition, and above all, freedom from government restriction are what foster human well-being. The harm from coerced, that is, from government-fostered monopoly, is well known. And Sheldon Richmond says the harm is just as bad in the production of knowledge as it is in the production of goods. It's a triple whammy for the taxpayers. They get robbed, they get regimented, and they get fear-mongering junk science for their trouble. Well, that kind of makes sense. If you want to check this out, maybe share it with some friends, take a look at my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. You will find a link to this article as well as others. In fact, you will find an entire section of my website dedicated to resources for wrong thinkers. If you like to read, you're going to find it heavenly. If you don't like to read, might not be a bad idea to build up that habit until it becomes enjoyable.
This is The Brian Hyde Show.